You're listening to a recording from the Roger Smith Hotel in anticipation of the upcoming Roger Smith Hotel Cookbook Conference taking place February 7th through 9th, 2013.
I'm Andy Smith, one of the organizers for the Roger Smith Cookbook Conference scheduled for February 7th through 9th at the hotel on Lexington Avenue. My co-host today is Katie Kiefer. Katie?
Thank you very much, Andy. I am indeed Katie Kiefer from the Heritage Radio Network. I run a show called Straight No Chaser on Sunday afternoons. And in the studio with us today, we have the wonderful Ann Mendelson and the equally wonderful Kathy Kaufman. Ann, I hardly even know how to introduce you, but I know that you're one of the most important and interesting food writers.
The most important,
yeah,
I think, is
pretty
the
close
statement to it.
Your book Milk, for instance, about the dairy industry was a real eye-opener for me, and I'm sure there are many other titles that I'm not remembering. And Kathy, you, who I know less well, you are a former professional chef, but you teach classes in culinary history, so a culinary historian.
That's right.
At the Institute for Culinary Education, ICE.
Yep. And you were a consultant on historical dining to Sotheby's Institute of Art. Fascinating. The Merchant's House Museum, which everybody should know. It's downtown.
Charming little spot.
Fantastic museum. Absolutely charming. National Arts Club and the Italian Cultural Foundation of America. You're the chairman of Culinary Historians of New York since 2003. And you
They won't let me go.
Well, why would they? You launched the story.
You
about
foolishly
food.
Were elected in the first place.
I know.
And you didn't see it was elected for life. Wasn't that one?
Yeah.
Didn't read the fine print.
But you're also the author of Cooking in Ancient Civilizations, which was recently translated into Arabic, which I think is fascinating.
I think it's fascinating to see my name in Arabic. It's such a strange experience to look at a book that you wrote and not be able to read a word of it.
Yeah, that must be very weird. And did they change your jacket a lot?
Yes, they did, and they made a couple of egregious mistakes. They've got tomatoes on the cover, which would not have been in the ancient world.
I
was gonna say.
I don't understand that.
Yeah, I don't know, but oh well.
So they translated it, but they didn't read it.
Clearly.
Both Ann and Kathy are also organizers for the Roger Smith Cookbook Conference, and so we can blame them for all of the things that are happening at the conference. They're in addition to doing the organizing, they're also on panels. In this case, Kathy is on Culinary Politics, White House Cooking and Cookbooks. And in addition, the second panel is For Such Kind Borrowing as This, If It Not Be Bettered by the Borrower Among Good Writers Is According to Plagiary. Do I have that right?
It's accounted plagiary.
It's accounted plagiary. You and John Milton both, yeah.
Well, we were just actually talking about that with one of the other conference attendees, a panelist named Arthur Schwartz. I'm sure you know Arthur.
Yes.
And he was talking about that very thing, and that one of the things that most insulted him in discussing with his editor was she asked him who wrote his recipes and if they had been tested.
That's not a very diplomatic question to ask.
I think it's like go back to editor school, man.
Well, Arthur was also correctly complaining about theft, where
yes.
recipes and books are stolen
yes.
and
names
put on the internet.
Names will not be named, but yes.
No, but also his own recipes, which have been used on the web by other people, and there's
sure.
no citation
with no
at
accreditation,
all.
Yes.
And that's an important issue that needs to be discussed. Anne is on two panels, one of which she is chairing, Give Us This Bread, Christianity in Cookbooks, and the second one, Star Power, The Abiding Fascination of Chefs, Cookbooks, and Restaurant Recipe Collection.
Star power, yeah.
Star power, yes. It hauls them in. It sells books. Whether it sells good books, that's another question.
So, Kathy, I want to know about this White House politics. What is this about culinary politics and White House cooking?
You think that there were dueling chocolate chip cookie recipes in the 1992
Bush
election?
Bush versus Clinton, as I
Bush
recall.
Bush versus Clinton, exactly. The question was who had better chocolate chip cookie recipes, and Hillary as the first, quote, career woman. It was a little bit of a stretch, or at least some people thought it was a stretch for her to come up with a chocolate chip cookie recipe. But if I recall, I think her recipe was voted superior, at least by the Democrats.
One.
At least by the Democrats. You know, these things are always biased. There's a tremendous amount of politics that goes on in the White House kitchen in terms of who should be the chef? Should the chef be the best chef, which traditionally was thought to be a French chef, or should it be an American chef? And that was one of the innovations that the Clintons introduced, at least in modern history, was having an American-trained chef rather than a French chef. They actually got rid of the French pastry chef who had been there for 25 years, Roland Messier. We will actually have a member of the panel who has worked tirelessly with him, who will be talking about his cookbook and his 25 years of service there.
Amazing. I guess the Clintons preferred chicken fried steak to Genoise.
Well, you see, there's a lot of chili that's gone down at the White House over the past 40 years
Bush
when you think about it.
The administration was very deep into that kind of American style down-home cooking.
Absolutely. And you can go back to Lyndon Johnson.
I bet you
know,
can.
And you will see.
Let's have a barbecue.
Barbecue and chili. It's good stuff. Good stuff.
And now with the Obama administration and the whole focus on the Victory Garden that Michelle has planted and the fact that they have Sam Cass, who's a big advocate for feeding our children better, feeding our families better, it's a whole different attitude towards the political stance of the White House chef. It's kind of really brought something new in.
President Obama himself is no longer going publicly into fast food restaurants. So
really?
He has made this important political decision.
That is an important political decision, actually. I think that's fascinating.
Yeah, and it is still very interesting what a raw nerve it can hit with people depending on their political leanings. I was chatting with a woman who died in the world Republican, not appreciative of Mrs. Obama's efforts. I mean, when I asked her, what do you think about the education of children with eating right, because she'd been complaining about the obesity problem and our kids are not taught how to eat. It really was just a complete conversation stopper. So the politics really do influence people's reactions to what is the food that should be taught, that should be eaten. It's a pretty fascinating first family, first dinner table.
Well, I can't wait to hear this panel. It's going
to
be fantastic.
I look forward to that panel. And we've had lots of books on Jewish cooking, and there are actually some books now on Arabic cooking and halal. And in addition to that, there's lots of vegan and vegetarian cookbooks, many of which are Hindu-oriented. So why have a panel on Christianity and cookbooks?
I've always wondered why there are so few books about Christianity and food. The only exception is the Christmas season when
Christmas cookies are there.
You get cookies and you get stolen and stuff like that. But Christianity really has a very rich repertory of holidays, as much so as Judaism, or more so. They're all the saints' days, and every saint has a different emblem. Many saints have emblems that are reproducible to an extent in food. And there's a food symbol at the heart of Christianity, the Eucharist.
And also the fish. I mean, Jesus is often depicted. Isn't that symbol of Christianity?
The loaves and fishes.
And the lamb.
I'm not a religious type, so. Mm-hmm. But I'm just saying, I've seen that around quite a bit.
And then supposedly, at least at Easter in Spain, at least this is what I've been told, and Kathy can correct me on this, they would serve pork at Easter in order to show that you're a true Christian and not a Jew. So
not a converso.
Not a Muslim.
Right,
so
right.
I just want you to know that this was the way to demonstrate your Christianity by was eating pork.
Well, I started life as a medievalist.
And this is not true. Is that correct? Wow. That's why we're having these sessions at the cookbook conference here at the Roger Smith Hotel.
So I read a great deal of Christian poetry in my days as a medievalist. And I probably know more about Christianity than about Judaism, in spite of the name Mendelssohn. I'm just fascinated by the lack of attention to many things about Christianity in the 21st century. And there's this rich, very, very rich heritage of food symbols, of actual foods. Come St. Joseph's Day, you'll see the Italian Cipoli. Or come St. Lucy's Day in Scandinavia. The Lucia cats, these little cat-shaped cakes. Unless you happen to have some special ethnic interest, you kind of don't hear about these things. They don't get discussed among non-members of the community. They don't get really collected and done justice to in cookbooks. Although we have one member of the panel who wrote the book that is the exception proving the rule, Evelyn Berg-Witz, who wrote a wonderful cookbook, well, it must be about 30 years ago now. And I think the title is A Continual Feast or A Perpetual Feast. Anyhow, it's still in print 30-some years later, courtesy of a small Catholic publishing house in California. It was originally done by Harper and Row in New York. But it's a lovely collection of recipes and legends. And Evelyn, who is really nicknamed Timmy, happens to be a medievalist.
What a surprise.
Yes. And so we met a number of years ago and had a great deal to talk about. And this is how I inveigled her onto the panel.
That sounds fascinating, Anne. And I'm just loving the sound of this garbage truck outside of Lexington Avenue. It's
We're on the street level on Lexington Avenue, waving to people walking by and having hello. And we just wanted you to know we're really at the hotel on the street itself.
That's right. But that sounds fascinating. I mean, I think of Catholics being more mindful in general of what feast days and what you ate on feast days. But I think as it goes to other branches of Christianity, that sort of component of food kind of fell away from the way people tended to practice their faith. I mean, I don't think of Episcopalians as having a specific dish, whereas I know Catholics, for instance, on Christmas have the seven-course feast that goes through
a very specific ritual.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I guess the Spanish don't do that, or the
different groups do it,
and they do it differently. But I mean, when you get into sort of Lutheran or you know the other branches of Christianity that aren't Catholic, and of which there must be, I don't know, 15 or so at least, right? Unitarian, Baptist, hundreds maybe. But they don't seem to have the same culinary traditions, and I think that's curious. Why do you suppose that is?
Well, I don't want to go through the history of the Reformation and the way they abolished
Saint
James.
Those are things on the panel. Come on, you're trying to push her to say what's going to be said on the panel.
But that was kind of an article of faith with Calvin and Luther and so forth. We are not going to have all these saint days anymore because the saints are not the same thing as the Bible and the one true God. So things connected with Saint Day observances, they fell away.
I see.
But you find any church-going Baptist from the South who has a connection with, like, cemetery picnics.
There's a specific menu for that?
Well,
Or it's just an event?
It's an event, and there are some dishes that are kind of traditional, depending on what part of the South you're from. But other sects, they do have their food traditions. They're just not connected with the original liturgical year.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. I mean, for instance, the Swedes, I think, have a lot of different dishes that are associated with Swedish, whatever their favorite sect
is,
which of course I don't know.
And the Swedes and Norwegians are largely Lutherans.
Right.
I mean, Luther didn't manage to get rid of everything he wanted to get rid of in the way of Saint Day.
Yes, because they still observe Saint Lucia.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's true. Also, are you going to deal with fast days? And the foods that are served there, because you do continue to have, at least within the Catholic religion, as well as in a number of Orthodox, Eastern Orthodox religions, you still have series of fast days that are also certainly associated with certain types of food. When I was growing up, of course, Catholic, we only had we had fast days on Friday.
Well, that meant
that meant we couldn't eat meat, and so that's when I fell in love with both peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and tuna sandwiches. So both of these ended up as books. So I just want you to know that some Catholic culinary traditions have lived on in those of us who are recipients of those
long
traditions.
Long into the 21st century, that's right.
Kathy, I want to know about plagiarism. Why are you going to be dealing with this, and what are you going to? What are the topics you're going to be dealing with in that panel?
Well, plagiarism is a really tough difficult topic and sensitive issue for people, because the real problem, as I see it, is that so many recipes, and let's forget about all of the embellishment that you put on a recipe in terms of the head notes and things like that in a cookbook, all the descriptive stories that go in, that stuff is all easily copyrighted, and there really shouldn't be a significant question about that. But my question, what I really want to look at and what we are going to be investigating, is as a chef or recipe writer, what is that nugget of creativity that should be protected? Or is it like so many other things, when you get a basic recipe for, say, bechamel sauce? How difficult is it to make a bechamel sauce? You need a little flour, you need a little butter, you may have some seasonings, you need a little milk and cream, and yeah, there are a lot of different varieties. But it's basically the same formula, time in, time out. How can you copyright your bechamel sauce, or should you be able to copyright it? I think that's really the question we're going to be looking at. We've got a practicing attorney who will be on the panel, who has written about the copyrightability of recipes, looking at some of the very high-end, the celebrity chefs who are doing what he considers very creative things that should be copyrighted. Full disclosure, I practiced law for 10 years before becoming a chef.
But you're a recovering lawyer.
I am a recovering lawyer. And I actually don't think recipes qua recipes should be copyrightable. If they're that creative, I think they should be patentable. But that's going to be a whole specific debate that we're going to have. And we've also got an editor or someone who has done some editing and quite a bit of writing, who will talk a bit about what it is you look at, what brings up red flags, and what makes you think we've got an issue here or we don't have an issue here. It really is going to be a philosophical discussion, I hope, more than nuts and bolts of this is what you do to protect yourself. There will be a panel on nuts and bolts, but this one isn't it. This is the one, what is it is that is creative? What do we want to protect? How do we want to reward people for something new? Or if it's not new, do we just want to admit, this ain't new, let's just, you know, get over it and say, you know, fine, I've done a recipe, my head note will be different, but the text of the recipe, it's a formula. It's a scientific formula.
I was hoping the panel would also deal with punishing those who steal our work and put it up on the web without credit.
That may be your practical panel. If you'd like, we could get some stocks, though, and, you know, have some people and maybe some rotten tomatoes. Andy, would you like some rotten tomatoes?
The rotten tomato part.
Anne can advise us on some particularly gruesome tortures.
we can get that, but yes, you know, in deference to Andy, we'll have lots of rotten tomatoes that we can throw at people.
All right. Anne, what is the star power and cookbook? Why do we have this fascination with chefs, and other than my coffee table French Laundry cookbook, which I've never used? So why do other people buy these star chef cookbooks?
Well, the panel is certainly going to ask the question. I don't know if we'll answer it, but I am just dumbfounded at the amount of chef worship that goes on now, and how fast it's growing, how little it existed even 20, 25 years ago. I mean, there were chefs, but they were not rock stars. And now it's just a cliche to say that cooking is the new rock and roll and chefs are the rock stars. How did it happen? Well, historically, I don't think eminent cooks had much of a pulpit or a platform to broadcast their name from until maybe like the 17th century, Kathy, would you? I mean, Robert Mays, the accomplished cook, was one of the first kind of star vehicles for a professional cook. But how many copies could that have sold? A few hundred, probably, in his
today,
lifetime.
Tens of thousands.
And one of our panelists, Paul Friedman, a historian, is going to be talking about a later development connected with Delmonico's, the great 19th century New York restaurant. There was a book called The Epicurean by Charles Ranhofer, one of the chefs in the heyday of Delmonico's. And that must have been an incredible boondoggle for anybody to buy. It was huge. It was full of the most elaborate illustrations for how to decorate things, garnishes, and little this isn't that that you put on top of the pie or the
hors d'oeuvre. Still an incredible cookbook, though. I look at that and marvel at it.
Well, I do, but who uses it? Or who was the intended audience?
Who could ever have cooked from it? Even when it came out, who could have cooked from it?
Other professional chefs who wanted to emulate what was the most fashionable restaurant in New York.
When it came out, one of the owners of Delmonico's bitterly complained and said, now that all our secrets are out, no one's going to come to Delmonico's.
No one's going to do it at home, so you still have a market there.
But I think you're right, Kathy. I think that it was very much a vehicle for one hotel chef to learn from another hotel chef. And hotels, I think, were primarily the top-of-the-line restaurants, correct me if I'm wrong,
yeah, but Delmonico's was not associated with a hotel.
They were not, but they were one of the first restaurants that was not associated with a hotel that enjoyed that kind of popularity. Isn't that true?
They enjoyed that kind of esteem.
Yes, yeah.
Prestige.
So it was really for the other chefs, I think, to learn and emulate and to take it across the country because we were settling up the west of the United States, no?
Well, it's a funny thing. A few years before, I think it was before, maybe Andy can correct me if I'm wrong, there had been another cookbook connected with Delmonico's, and I think...
Alessandro Filippini.
Filippini, right? Yeah. Filippini, and what was the title of that? Anyhow, that was interesting because... Mark Twain was then trying to get into book publishing with his son-in-law, Charles Webster. And Filippini's book was published by Webster's company. And it was a much cheaper production. It was a smaller book, a much smaller format. It was another attempt to cash in on the Delmonico's name and associations. But I think it didn't have any great success. Do you have any idea?
Well, do you think that was because it wasn't big and fancy and beautiful like the Ranhofer version? Or do you think... Because I think of like the old cookbooks that I have. Some of them were very... You know, the old gourmet cookbook, for instance, the really early one, the first one that they published, I think, in the 40s or 50s. That was a very big, hefty tome.
Around 1950, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I have that.
This group is having too much fun, right? And you want to do the conference right here on radio.
I know. Well, I do want to continue to pick Kathy and Ann's brains.
I understand. And we can do that again when we're at the Roger Smith Conference, February 7th through 9th. At the Roger Smith Hotel on Lexington Avenue. And again, I'm Andy Smith, one of the organizers for the Cookbook Conference with two of the other organizers for the Cookbook Conference, Ann Mendelson and Kathy Kaufman, and my co-host, Katie Kiefer.
Thank you, Andy. And don't forget the schedule, the lineup of guests, and the tickets are all available on the Cookbook Conference website. That's cookbookconf.com. So check it out.
I didn't
sign
get that.
Up now.
What was the website again?
Yeah. And by the way, there is an early bird special. So if you buy your tickets or sign up to register before, what is it, January 17th?
15th,
you get a lower price. I don't know if it's substantially lower, but it is a lower price. And you won't want to miss a minute of this conference. I can tell it's just going to be amazing. Thanks so much for joining us today, Kathy and Ann. It's really been a pleasure.
Thank you. Our pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this interview. Visit heritageradionetwork.org for the complete set of recordings from the Roger Smith Hotel.